Dear brethren, we're looking forward to a rich blessing with our brother David. It's a blessing for us all to have him with us again to minister to us on the Lord's Word. And also, it's nice to have brethren from out of town. We notice Brother Tim Krupa's here, Brother Jim Parkinson from out of town. And we have brethren from Phoenix, so we welcome all of you. Nice to have you with us. Brother David has chosen as his subject, Understanding Armageddon. Armageddon has been in the news so greatly of late because of the war in the Middle East. And so we're looking forward to have greater insight into the Lord's Word on the subject of Armageddon. Brother David.
First of all, I think it'd be nice to recognize and tell our Seventh-day Adventist friends that we appreciate them allowing us to meet together here in this place. And we appreciate that very much. And I'm sure we're all very happy to be here. Shirley and I are especially happy to be with you at this time. And we bring with us the love and greetings of the Seattle class. We brought, there are two other members of our group here, Ginger and Michael, and then others will be joining us at Hope College for the General Convention. But we all send, they all send their greetings to you and an invitation to join with us over the Labor Day weekend at a convention in the Seattle area. And if you're interested at all, we have programs and little cards that you can sign and reserve a room at the Holiday Inn where the convention will be held and save you a postage stamp. So we'd like to see you all there. As many as can come, be there with us at that time. I think a more appropriate title might have been starting a start on understanding Armageddon. The more I looked into the matter of Armageddon, the bigger it became, and it's far too great a subject to try to cover in just one short hour period or whatever time we have available to us. But it can be a beginning to understand Armageddon. So I want you all to understand that this is not going to be a complete picture of what Armageddon may be like as we look at the scriptures and try to figure out what God is planning for mankind at that time. In fact, if you think of it as an apple pie, or if you don't like apple pie, make it pumpkin pie or whatever kind of pie you want, this is just one little wedge out of the pie. There are many scriptures that talk about this period of time that in Revelation, the 16th chapter, is called Armageddon. You might want to turn to Revelation, the 16th chapter. We're going to leave a lot unsaid that you might think I should have included in a discussion of Armageddon, but we're really going to probably approach it from just two segments, the one in Revelation and the other one in the book of Joel. Armageddon, what is it? Some religiously oriented drugstore paperbacks describe it as a gathering of the armies of Russia, United States, and maybe China, and many other nations to a plain in northwest Israel. To journalists, Armageddon is a is a word that they use for to describe any titanic struggle, whether it's military or otherwise. And others are not sure what it is. They have a vague idea of some frightening future nuclear battle or something like that. How do we sort out which is the correct idea about this term, Armageddon? Well, we have to go to the Bible because that's where the expression is found. It's in Revelation, the 16th chapter, and we'd like to read verses 12 to 16. Revelation 16, verses 12 to 16. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Now, verse 15, we kind of feel is a parenthetical thought, so we'll just go right to verse 16. It says there, he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Now, according to these texts, verses 14 and 16, there's to be a great battle. And it's to be participated in by the kings of the whole world. And the place where they're supposed to be gathered is a place called Armageddon. Now, from this passage and related passage, a description of the battle and the events leading up to it can be pieced together. When will this gathering take place? Everybody wants to know, is this battle, when the Iraq battle began, most newspapers said, is this Armageddon? Or will this lead to Armageddon? When will it take place? Well, according to what we just read, it takes place, or at least something takes place at the time when the sixth angel pours out his vial. That's what it says. But some might say, well, I thought that Armageddon was still future, and that the sixth angel pouring out his vial had already taken place. And that's right. The answer to that is that this gathering, the gathering begins to take place during the time that the sixth angel pours out his vial and continues on to even include the time of the seventh plague. Now, how is this accomplished, this gathering? Well, modern technology makes it very easy. The great increase of knowledge that has taken place has brought all nations very close together. We've all heard many people say the world is getting smaller. Well, the world is not literally getting smaller. We know that. So it's simply an indication of something that we all know. Now, at one time, to get from, we'll say, France to the United States would have taken many, many months by a sailing vessel, or many weeks later by one of our giant ocean liners. Today, it is only a matter of several hours. And many of us have had the experience of flying from here to France or from France to the United States in just a short time, just a few hours, and we're there. This battle of Armageddon brings to an end the long struggle between good and evil. I think I got my pages mixed up. We were talking about how quickly we get from France to the United States and the United States to France. And how it's just a matter of hours. Actually, if we take a trip from France to the United States by the Concorde airplane, one almost gets to the United States before they have left France. The plane travels faster than the sunlight. And I've traveled from France to the United States, and we would look down at that ocean, and we'd see nothing but darkness. And then we would suddenly see light. I guess we were traveling from the United States to France. We'd suddenly see light because the sunlight was coming upon us. But this airplane travels faster than that sunlight. And so we can see how quickly people can be gathered together in that sense. And as a matter of fact, we don't even have to leave our homes to be gathered together with somebody in France. We can call them on the telephone, and in just a split second, someone in France answers, and we are gathered together in that sense. And so this is the form, a form rather, of being gathered together ever since that sixth angel poured out his vial. We've come closer together as nations, as people, as family members who may have some family members in other countries. We can gather together on the telephone or get together in just a matter of hours, one with another, and enjoy each other in that sense. So this gathering together is done by this modern technology that has come to light. Now, according to this text, these kings are gathered into a place that's called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Well, where is Armageddon? This is a question with which many Bible scholars have struggled. The problem is there's no geographical site by that name anywhere on the earth. However, many have connected the second part of that name with Megiddo. In Old Testament times, a small city in northwest Israel. All that is there now is a hill of ruins called the Tel El Mutasalim. But what about the first portion of that name, AR? Actually, in the Greek, the original language of the New Testament, the prefix is H-A-R, har, which can be significant due to the fact that the word Armageddon is said to be a Hebrew word. The place where these armies are gathered together is called in the Hebrew tongue properly then Harmageddon. Har in the Hebrew tongue means mountain. Mountain. It is a common word in the Old Testament. So if we are correct then, the term Harmageddon means Mountain of Megiddo. Well, what or where is the Mountain of Megiddo? Is there a mountain named by that name? No, there isn't. Could it be the ruined hill called Tel El Mutasalim? I don't think so. Some have suggested that it could simply mean a general area, approximately where Megiddo was formerly located and where many ancient battles took place. Well, how do we find out? Is it purely a symbolic place And that question would naturally come to mind because this text is in the book of Revelation, and Revelation is a book composed largely of symbolic statements and symbols of various kinds that we have to interpret in order to understand. Well, we'll come back to that after we'll deal with another question. Who fights whom in this battle? Well, the battle is clearly called the battle of the great day of God Almighty. This then means that it must be something different than a conventional battle among opposing nations like the United States versus Russia or Israel versus Syria or something like that. Other portions of the book of Revelation give us a little more detail on this battle. We're going to go to Revelation, the 19th chapter, verses 11 and 19, although we may skip a few verses in between. Revelation 19, verses 11 to 19. And we read there that I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he doth judge and make war. I notice we want to remember that in this picture, this includes the thought of someone making war. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in white linen, white and clean. Now, obviously, this refers to Christ and the church in glory. And then he goes on, I saw the beast and the kings of earth. Now, we see this is the same language that he had in Revelation, the 16th chapter, and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the white horse and against his army. So this battle scene that is presented to us here is to be fought at Armageddon, is to be between the forces of evil on the earth against Christ and the church. It will be the final climactic battle when Christ and the church defeat and put an end to the existing powers of earth. And this battle of Armageddon brings to an end the long struggle between good and evil. And a history of this battle or this event is really the theme of the book of Revelation. We find in it the fact that evil powers make war with God's people and they're allowed to overcome them. In Revelation, the 13th chapter, verse 7, we read this. That's Revelation 13, verse 7. It says, and it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power or authority, as the Diaglot puts it, was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And you remember, Jesus himself called Satan the prince of this world in John, the 12th chapter, verse 31, and in John 14, verse 30. And we have all kinds of disasters come upon mankind. Floods, earthquakes, starvation, pestilence, wars among nations, wars within nations, among races, among different religious groups, and so on. But in among these is this war of Satan against the saints. And each member of the church has had to have their own war to fight. And as they have fought faithfully even unto death, so they shall be a part of that heavenly army to finally remove Satan from power that we read about in Revelation, the 19th chapter. And in Revelation, the 6th chapter, verses 9 and 10, the saints are symbolically pictured as if speaking. And it says there that the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held, cry with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And then they are told, or they are comforted, that it will be just a little season. In verse 11, it says, Before God intervenes, during which time some more of their brethren will have to go through similar trials. But eventually that time will come when the church is completed. And in Revelation 14, verses 1 to 7, we see the church completed, 144,000 of them, sing the new song, the song of Moses and the Lamb. They have learned the words to that wonderful song. Wonderful words. Do we know the words of that song? If I ask you to stand up and sing this song of Moses and the Lamb, could you do it? Could I do it? I hope we can. The words to the song, by the way, are found in Revelation 15, verses 3 and 4. But it's very important that we must know the words of that song, because if we don't, we're not going to be a part of that wonderful army of God following Christ, robed with white robes, and singing the song. We have to know the words before we can get up there and be a part of that whole group. So it's very important that we know the words to the song of Moses and the Lamb in Revelation 15, 3 and 4. Then in verse 6, we're back in Revelation 14 now. An angel comes along having the everlasting gospel, saying in verse 7, the hour of his, that is God's, judgment has come. God is finally going to take charge and take away Satan's permission to control the earth. It follows and says in verse 8, Babylon is fallen, as if to say, because he repeats it, it really is fallen this time. Babylon in this case not only represents the counterfeit religious systems, but the combined religious and civil powers. And in a recent study on volume 4 in our class, we found that it's spoken of in that way on page 79. And I'm quoting now. He says, Babylon, Christendom, the present organization and order of society as represented by her statesmen and clergy, is being weighed in the balances of public opinion and is found wanting. The handwriting is on the wall. It's on the wall. Some see it and some don't. But they're waiting for the church to be completed before Babylon is completely destroyed. And as a sixth angel then pours out the contents of his bowl, its contents strike, it says, the river Euphrates. And it dries up, enabling the kings of the east to march to Armageddon, to this battle, because it was given to Jesus to make war with those who are opposing God on the earth. But how can the evil forces of the earth fight with Christ and the church, who are spirit beings? Will the church take on human flesh so that there can be a literal battle? I don't think any of us think that's a possibility. Well, how will it be done? Well, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that God has a representative nation here on the earth. Now, in a sense, that nation doesn't even know it. I mean, in a sense. But it is there, established by God, just as he promised. But again, someone will say most nations of the earth do not see that nation as God's nation. And that's true also. What has to happen first is that Israel itself must make that claim. Israel itself must make the claim that it is a nation which represents God, that they are God's people. Now, how did God deal with Israel in times past? In most cases, and I think it probably was in all cases, but I don't want to over-exaggerate, because there might have been one or two cases when this didn't happen in this manner. But in most cases, we find that God waited for the people to return to a worship of the true God before he would deliver them from captivity. Most of the time, the people would cry unto God and say, God, help us. And then he would enter in and deliver them. And that's kind of important to remember, that it was usually after they had called to him, repented, and returned to worship him, that God performed this miraculous deliverance from their enemies. And in the book of Joel, we have a description of the same scene that in Revelation is called Armageddon. In Joel, the third chapter, verses 12 to 14, we have Joel speaking about this same type of thing, the gathering of all nations for a battle. In Joel 3, verses 12 to 14, and we'll read that. And we have a place called here the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And just prior to this, in verse 10 and 11, by the way, let me read this. It kind of sets the time element for us when it says in verse 10, beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. And I think we all realize this has been happening ever since the sixth angel poured out his vial. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord. Then it goes on in verse 12. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now there it doesn't call it the valley of Armageddon or Harmageddon. It calls it the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full, the fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. Now there's another name for this valley. Valley of decision. Valley of Jehoshaphat. Armageddon. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. Well, what's the story about Jehoshaphat? Why does Joel call this the valley of Jehoshaphat? Well, something very important happened in the time of Jehoshaphat. And in my opinion, this example of God's power and ability to deliver the people stands, I think, next in magnitude to the deliverance of the children of Israel from Egypt, when God miraculously delivered them across the Red Sea and eventually into the Promised Land. This, in my opinion, is second. One of the second greatest examples of God delivering his people and giving them the victory. And actually, you'd have to read chapters 17 through 20, but most of our remarks are going to be on chapter 20. And it turns out that Jehoshaphat is a son of Asa. Asa is a former king. His father was king of Judah and Benjamin, the two-tribe kingdom. Now, Asa was a good king, too. Jehoshaphat was a better one. Asa was good. He destroyed the idols. He destroyed the temples of idol worship and so on, the groves. But Asa made a mistake. While he was king of Israel, it turns out that Baasha, the king of Israel, which is the 10-tribe kingdom, came down to Ramah to build a fortification on the road that led to Jerusalem. Too many of the people of Israel were fleeing to Judah. And so Baasha decides, I'm going to build a fort along here so that the people can't escape. And so that the people from Judah can't come into my country either. But Asa found out about it. And Asa writes to the king of Syria and says, here's some silver and gold. If you'll just please attack Israel, maybe I can get Baasha to stop building this fortification on the road to Jerusalem. And the king of Syria does it. He's an old friend of Asa's and even his father. So they get together and then Asa comes along and takes down all the fortifications that were built by Baasha. But Asa's mistake was to go to Syria to get help against an enemy. He should have gone to God. He should have prayed to the Lord for help. And the Lord would have delivered him, but he didn't do it. And the prophet, I think his name was Hanani, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Hanani tells him, you made a mistake. You should have called upon God to help you. And because you didn't, you're going to have war from now on. And he did. He had nothing but trouble after that. And he finally died a few years later. But now along comes Jehoshaphat, and he's a good king. He does wonderful things. He tries to finish the work of destroying the idols and the groves. And he even sends out the Levites and the priesthood throughout the whole land. And he himself travels over the whole land, mixing with the people in order to get them back to a worship of God. Jehoshaphat does the job, and the people do turn to God. And so eventually the people are prospering and are successful, and they're enjoying life. It's almost like the days of Solomon when everything was going along just wonderfully, and their enemies were afraid of them, with some exception. But in the meantime, all the people are turning back to God and worshiping the true God. Well, the news gets around that the people aren't, being as careful as they could be with their defense of the land. And the nations of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, this is in chapter 20, verse 10, gathered together to invade the land of Judah and Benjamin. Mount Seir is the same as Edom. And Edom, we know, was the nation that came from Esau. They were the ones who descended from Esau, who was the brother of Jacob. And they gathered together to go against the Judah and Benjamin because it says it looks like they're almost like a land with unwalled villages. They don't have any kind of a defense. We can really get in and take a spoil. Now, Jehoshaphat is informed about this army coming in to Judah and to Benjamin, and he prays to God. He does the right thing. He learned from his father's mistake, you see. So Jehoshaphat prays to God, and this is in the 20th chapter of 2 Chronicles. And among the many things that he says, we notice in verse 12, he says, we have no might against this great company that comes against us. and neither know we what to do. Evidently, they've been pursuing peaceful things so long that they just don't know how to defend themselves in a battle with another army. And so Jehoshaphat tells God that this is the situation, Lord. You've got to help us. And, of course, God does. I love that 13th verse where it says, all Judah stood before the Lord with their little ones, their wives, and their children. I kind of picture a wonderful scene of a gathering of the people to pray to God. And kind of a silence goes over the group. And then they have their heads bowed. Then comes an answer from God. And this is in chapter 20, verses 14 to 17. And God speaks to them through a Levite named Jehaziel. He said, hearken ye, be not afraid. The battle is not yours, but God's. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, and see the salvation of the Lord. And what an encouragement that must have been to them to receive this answer immediately through the servant of God. And I think we have to remember that ourselves, as we are God's people now. We have the same right to go to God when we see trouble coming and say, God, I've done all I can. I don't know what else to do. And God will tell us, well, sit still. The battle isn't yours. I'll take care of it. But we have to have faith in order to leave it with the Lord. But we want to try to learn that lesson from this little account, too, in addition to all the other lessons that we are getting. And then we see the people going out to a place in the wilderness called the wilderness of Tekoa, which is a sort of a plateau area. And from that, they can look down into a valley and look down into the valley where this army is approaching Jerusalem. This army composed of the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. Well, what happened? God confuses them. He confuses them. The Ammonites and the Moabites start fighting the Edomites. They kind of get together and they say, I'm not sure about these Edomites. Maybe we better take care of them first. We're entering the land very well now. We don't need them. Let's destroy them. And so they enter into a battle against the Edomites. And then they fight each other. The Moabites and the Ammonites fight each other. Verse 23 and 24, it says, they fought each other, and everyone helped to destroy another, and none escaped. God took care of the whole thing. They didn't have to fight. They didn't have to use their arms at all. They just stood there and watched from this high plateau down into this valley and saw how God delivered them. Then after this, the people go down. It takes them 3 days to gather up the spoil that's left after all these soldiers died. 3 days they gathered and gathered and gathered and finally gathered all together. And on the fourth day in verse 26, I have another beautiful picture. It says, on the fourth day they assembled themselves in the valley of Beraka. And the word Beraka means blessing. They gathered in the valley called the Valley of Blessing. And then they went home. Now, inasmuch as Joel refers us to this experience and reminds us of this experience and says, this valley is the valley of Jehoshaphat. He's referring to that battle where the people didn't have to fight at all, but God did the delivering for them. I wonder if perhaps we might not expect to see something similar as a part of the final phase of trouble that we call Armageddon. Perhaps, and I'm saying perhaps now, perhaps we may expect to see some leader arise in Israel who will call the people back to a worship of the true God. Lead them away from their present commercially oriented attitude, mental attitude, to a more God-like trust, like Jehoshaphat did. Perhaps at a time like that, when God sees them repenting and crying out for help, he may perform this kind of a miracle or something like that in delivering his people. And I think that that's all a part of this picture that we have about Armageddon. It's worth thinking about. Joel's prophecy about the gathering of all nations to God's judgment, and Joel calls it a valley of decision. They're going to have to make decisions. And the gathering, we know, cannot be literal. All the nations of the world can't gather in that little plain just below this wilderness area. Not even representatively will they be there, but they will have to make decisions about Israel and what's to be done. And we know that probably they will vote to perhaps have sanctions against Israel because they're not cooperating in peace efforts. You know, we have a peace effort that's going, that they're trying to enter into now in Israel. And yet Israel's making it difficult for this peace conference to take place, and with them as a one of the parties in this peace effort. But somehow or other, it seems to me that possibly there must come some kind of a greater effort to worship the true God than we see in Israel at this time. Now, I've never been to Israel. I don't really know all that's going on there. I know that there are some Jews back there who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but I think they're a very small minority. And we know that the Jewish government has declared a policy of Christians can come there and have a place of worship, yes, but they cannot proselyte the Jews to turn to Christianity and accept Jesus as the Messiah. So at this point, they are turning away from God's arrangement for salvation. So until they turn back and accept Jesus as the Messiah, we see that they're still going to have some difficulties. But perhaps a leader will show up and do what Jehoshaphat did for the people, and then God will help them. So these are the thoughts that this is just a couple of pieces of the pie of this great big picture of Armageddon that is spoken of in the scriptures. And in order to really get the full picture, we have to use a lot more scriptures and go into a lot more detail. Scriptures such as Ezekiel the 38th and the 39th chapters. Zechariah, the 12th chapter, verses 2, 3, 8, and 9. Amos, the 9th chapter. Zechariah, the 14th chapter. Zephaniah, the 2nd chapter. And so there are many other parts to this pie that we have that involves a discussion about Armageddon. But I was especially intrigued by this reference to Jehoshaphat in the book of Joel, the 3rd chapter. And so I'm suggesting that perhaps that's going to be a part of what we can expect to see in the not too far distant future. We know that we all feel that the time is short before God will step into this picture and defend Israel against its many enemies. But there is still time for them to have a different heart attitude towards the true God and turn away from their commercialism and their own efforts to arm themselves with the arms that the United States is bringing to them ever since the Iraq war stopped. We've all read articles about how the United States is taking the arms that they had in Saudi Arabia and putting them in Israel for them to use as a defense against their enemies that still exist. Yet they haven't turned to God, and we're hoping and praying that they may, and then that'll bring the end time to a close that much sooner. So I hope that maybe this has comforted some of us as we realize that from that Revelation, the 19th chapter picture, which is all a part of the same scene, it shows the church as having been completed before that final phase of trouble comes upon the earth. And that should be a comforting thought to us. So let's keep on fighting our own personal battle with the devil and see if we can be victorious so that the church can be complete and God can enter this picture and bless mankind as he has promised. And we pray the Lord lend his blessings.